Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to today's webinar, The Changing Landscape of Securities Litigation, Mergers, Events-Based Securities Claims, and Emerging Litigation and Settlement Dynamics in Federal and State Courts, sponsored by the Law and Economics Center at George Mason University Scalia Law School. I'm Donald Koshin. I'm a professor of law here at Scalia Law School, and I also serve as the Deputy Executive Director of the Law and Economics Center, the sponsor of today's programming. I'll be moderating today's discussion, but before introducing our panelists, I want to take a brief moment to place this webinar in context with the mission and purpose of the LEC and its educational programming. The mission of the Law and Economics Center is to serve as a nexus for academic research and education that focuses on the timely and relevant economic analysis of legal and public policy issues affecting judges and policymakers nationwide. The vision of the Law and Economics Center is that when policymakers understand economics, when judges understand economics, they're more likely to make sound decisions that support the rule of law and the free enterprise system. And our commitment then is to developing original, high-quality law and economics programming like the program today to further enhance economic understanding, to engage in economic discussions, and to offer policy solutions from our panelists. We thank all of you for joining us today to be part of that ongoing dialogue. Our panel of three experts today each come to the discussion with extensive and diverse securities litigation experience. So that we can reserve time for substantive discussion, I'll not give extensive bios. They all have very impressive backgrounds and extensive experience on issues we'll discuss. And I recommend that you go to the email that you received after registering for this, or go to masonlec.org, that's masonlec.org, to click on the hyperlink and learn more about each of the panelists in more detail. So with that, I will introduce each of them in turn. Laura Hughes McNally is a partner at Morgan Lewis and will start us off. Following Laura will be comments from Stephen Toll, a partner at Cohen Milstein. And then finally, Kevin LaCroix, Executive Vice President of RT ProExec, and many of our listeners will be familiar with Kevin for his work running the informative website, The DNO Diary, a periodic journal containing items of interest from the world of directors and officers' liability with occasional commentary. Each panelist will speak for about 10 minutes. Then we'll have some intra-panel discussion in which I'll invite each of the panelists to remark on what they heard from the others, as well as to remark more generally on the topic. And then we're going to turn to audience Q&A, and we hope that throughout the program you will consider sending in questions. If you have a question, please use the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen to submit the question. Please identify yourself in the text of the message and keep your question short so that we can adapt to this virtual format more easily. Please do not chat directly with the panelists in the chat box, for they will not be able to see anything there. Please do use that Q&A box. If you are listening outside of the Zoom platform and would like to send us an email with your questions, that will also get to me as the moderator, and I'll be happy to pose those to the panelists. You can email your questions to ccjca@gmu.edu. That's ccjca@gmu.edu. Feel free to email there or submit questions at the bottom of the screen. So once again, I thank you all for joining us today for this lunch hour discussion, and I'll turn it over to Laura Hughes McNally, partner at Morgan Lewis, who will get us started with some opening remarks. Laura?
Good morning. Thank you so much, Donald, and thank you to my fellow participants and to the Law and Economics Institute for hosting us today. I'm hopeful that this is going to be a great panel, and looking forward to engaging in some interesting dialogue with Kevin and Steve. So we're each going to cover some trends that we think are going to be of interest to the participants here. And I am tasked with covering the first trend that we have kind of talked about as a group. And that is issues surrounding boardroom diversity. And the recent increase in shareholder litigation in this area. So, and then Kevin and Steve are both going to cover different, somewhat related, somewhat unrelated topics. But jumping into where I'm coming from and where I'm going, we've of course are all aware of the recent public outcry for racial and gender equity and genuine inclusion from the Me Too movement to Black Lives Matter that's been a part of our society and whatnot for the past few months and few years. And now these movements have really increased pressure on corporate boards to have more diverse members. And as a result, we've seen some laws, some private litigation, and most recently, a proposed rule from NASDAQ for companies listed on that exchange, all that are aimed at increasing not only the numbers of diverse board members, but also the transparency and reporting of the diversity statistics surrounding those board members. So the most recent development in this area has been a recent proposed rule from NASDAQ. NASDAQ just proposed this rule on, I believe it was December 1st, where it announced that it had submitted a proposed rule to the SEC to enhance diversity and increase transparency surrounding diversity. Now, if approved by the SEC, the new listing rule would require all companies listed on the NASDAQ's U.S. exchange to publicly disclose consistent and transparent diversity statistics regarding their boards through either their proxy statement or on their website. And it would also require most NASDAQ-listed companies to have, or, and this is key, explain why they don't have at least two diverse directors, including one who self-identifies as female and one who self-identifies as an underrepresented racial or ethnic minority or LGBTQ+. What was interesting to me as part of this NASDAQ rule was that they presented, in connection with the rule, over two dozen studies finding an association between diverse boards and better financial performance and board governance. So we've now seen there be some commentary in response to the rule. Some of it has been very positive. There has been some critical commentary. And NASDAQ just published in the Wall Street Journal yesterday or the day before a kind of a defense of why it is pushing this proposed rule. So it's been interesting to see some of the public discourse surrounding it. And NASDAQ modeled its approach after two diversity statutes that we've seen coming out of California. SB 826, which was passed in 2018, and that required board gender diversity. And a more recent regulation in California, AB 979, which was a California law requiring racial and ethnic or LGBTQ diversity. Now, they're similar, but different in lots of ways. One difference that I was reading about and thought was interesting was that AB 979 in California arguably includes North African, Middle Eastern, and Central Asian descent as diverse, whereas NASDAQ's definition of diverse does not include those definitions. So it'll be interesting to see if NASDAQ makes any revisions to its proposed rule. It'll also be interesting to see what any public comments are in response to the proposed rule. Now, I mentioned these California statutes, in particular about those California statutes and what public companies have increasingly become aware of is that they apply to public companies whose principal executive offices are located in California, regardless of the corporation's place of incorporation. So we all know that lots of companies are incorporated in Delaware, but the California statutes apply to any public company headquartered in California, even if you are incorporated in Delaware. So we see that companies are speaking up about increasing their diversity in response to these social movements. And if they haven't already stated a commitment to diversity among their executive ranks and among their board members, that there are going to be these laws and potentially listing rules which are going to require companies to speak about their commitment to diversity or state why they don't have a diverse board. So we're going to see more public statements from companies surrounding their diversity metrics and commitment to increasing diversity. And what does this lead to, of course, is private securities litigation. And already in the past, just in the past few months, I think we're up to about a dozen shareholder derivative lawsuits that have been brought against companies like Alphabet, which is Google's parent, The Gap, Danaher, NortonLifeLock, Qualcomm, Monster, Oracle, Advanced Micro Devices, Cisco, Facebook. Most recently, a suit was brought against Pinterest. And these are shareholder derivative suits, meaning that they are brought by a purported shareholder allegedly acting in the best interest of the corporation, and they are brought against the directors and officers, which are the named defendants. The corporation is the nominal defendant. And the shareholders allege a variety of state law breach of fiduciary duty claims, but these claims, these cases are actually brought in federal court because they typically involved what's called a proxy claim, which is brought under Section 14A of the Exchange of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which state that the corporation made false statements in its proxy statement, in its annual proxy statement. So the plaintiff shareholder goes through the corporation's prior proxy statements, combs through any public statements that are by the corporation or the chief executive officer, or often in these cases, the head of human resources, or if there's a diversity and inclusion executive, combs through any public statements by these people and finds anything that could possibly be what is alleged to be false and misleading regarding the company's efforts to diversify in its executive ranks and on its board. And I was asking Kevin, I emailed Kevin last night to say I hadn't located any actual decisions with respect to these claims because they've been so recent. So they really are this new spate of lawsuits. And Kevin assured me that he was not aware of any either. I wanted to make sure I hadn't missed any. So it'll be really interesting to see how courts deal with these lawsuits in response to what are called 23.1 demand futility motions and motions to dismiss that the defendants and nominal defendant are bringing in these cases, and to see what's happening. Not only do these cases pose litigation risk, of course, but also significant reputational risk for these companies. So it'll be interesting to see where these cases go, what type of settlement pressure gets placed on companies to deal with these cases before much reputational harm can be done. And we will, I'm sure, be talking about these cases and the laws and rules that are surrounding and promoting board diversity for the next few months and years to come. And with that, I want to turn it over to Steve, who is going to discuss event-driven litigation, so I can make sure I'm staying to my allotted 10 minutes. But I'd be happy to take any questions and offer any more perspective on this topic during the Q&A period. Thanks.
Thank you, Laura. So I am going to talk about event-driven litigation, and the question is, what does that mean? And it's very interesting because it's really a term or a label that, as far as I know, was created by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce as really a tool to attack securities class action lawsuits, which they have been doing for many years, decades, actually. Kevin may weigh in on the other issue of whether the insurance industry that he knows a lot about, who issue O&D or D&O policies that pay most of the money in many of the security settlements, whether they're probably supportive of this attack, because in a way, of course, it would limit these cases. The differences and what these cases are and how they've been labeled, they're different than the standard cases from many years ago. Most fraud cases many years ago were focused on accounting restatements, false financial reports, or cooking the book cases. But the securities laws are much broader than that. And these cases, given this label, although truthfully, I don't think I've seen courts use the label other than it's really mostly in articles, but it's where there's been a dangerous operations, catastrophic or adverse events, or illegal conduct that's been exposed, to which the stock market reacts negatively and the stock drops. I'll get into specifics in a little while, but some generic examples are, you know, an explosion and an oil spill, a dam collapse, emission scandals, data breaches, bribery schemes, the Me Too disclosures. And what's happened is the Chamber of Commerce has written numerous articles and really just, you know, kind of badmouth these cases and basically say the securities laws are running amok. These are all abusive cases. The system is broken. It's out of control. And we need legislative reform. And in my opinion, they've just got it all wrong. These cases keep corporations honest. Not all of them are meritorious. I'll get into that in a moment. But we still have the best, you know, capital markets in the world. These cases hold the corporations accountable, which they don't like. They give shareholders access to justice. And they often expose the falsity of the company's prior statements. You know, one needs to remember the whole purpose and the cornerstone of the securities laws is disclosure, proper disclosure of what's going on in a company's business so investors can determine whether to buy or hold or sell a stock. And one, again, in evaluating these cases, you really should ignore this label that's been placed on them by the chamber. The real issue in these cases is you have to look to whether a company has misrepresented the true state of affairs regarding its business and its conduct and its safety processes. And if investors cannot establish that in their complaint, the case is going to be dismissed. And there are some very tough standards plaintiffs must satisfy. They must show the statement's false or misleading, it's material and not just puffery, that the statement's made with knowledge or made recklessly, and that they can show loss causation, which is really linking the misconduct to the loss that's alleged. Now, some examples I'll give you of these cases, and these are ones, of course, to show that these cases are not abusive and not unjustified when you have sufficient facts to support the claim. Probably the most egregious example could be in terms of dollar amounts is the Petrobras scandal, which is a big bribery scheme in Brazil. And the company had basically allegedly misrepresented the basis for its profitability. The event that happened here was, supposed event, was that numerous indictments came down against company officials and public officials as well. And it led to a large stock drop. But when what the case was about is the company had said its profitability was based on numerous other factors when it became revealed that wasn't the case. It was due to the bribery scheme. Ultimately, investors recovered $3 billion. Again, an example, and the courts recognized that the case had real legs to it and had merit. The BP oil spill is another such example. Our firm was actually involved in that case. And BP had allegedly misrepresented its public filing its safety processes that it had in place. And then when the spill happened, how much oil was leaking into the Gulf of Mexico? BP had said it had a system in place, a safety process system to protect all its rigs. But in reality, the process had only been employed in the rigs that BP owned, not the ones that it leased. And where the explosion and spill occurred was a leased rig. In any event, the issue was the event, of course, that happened was the spill, the explosion and the spill. But again, to get by a motion to dismiss, you must have evidence to show that the company had been misrepresenting information about its safety processes. And otherwise, you're not going to survive. And the case did survive and recovered hundreds of millions of dollars for investors. A third example is a case called Household Finance, a predatory lending case where, again, the company had not disclosed that that was the basis of its profitability. And then you had the mortgage-backed security crisis based out of the financial crisis, where again, people lost a lot of money. The companies blamed the financial crisis, but in fact, they hadn't been following their own underwriting standards and were giving loans to people who couldn't afford to pay them back. So what is the takeaway? The takeaway is ignore the label, event-driven litigation that's been given. Securities fraud cases come in many shapes and sizes. It's not just cooking the books or falsifying revenue. Investors need and deserve this protection that the securities laws provide. They were enacted in the 30s following the Great Depression and the collapse of the markets. Congress should not cut back on these laws and make sure to protect investors the way they have been and not get caught up in the labels. And also, each case should be decided on its merits. Many cases are dismissed, probably a third to 40% of securities cases are dismissed. So the courts are doing a good job in weeding out the good ones from the bad ones. Thank you. The system is working. I'll turn it over to Kevin.
Thanks, Steve. When we get to the discussion part, I have some comments on the event-driven litigation. I'd be happy to come back to that. So I'm going to be talking about a development involving Section 11 litigation. Section 11 is the liability provision of the Securities Act of 1933. It's the statutory provision that applies to the initial issuance of securities into the marketplace, whether through an IPO or a secondary offering. There have been 33 act liability actions since the 30s by definition, but there's been a recent significant development involving a U.S. Supreme Court decision in March 2018. The name of the case is Cyan, C-Y-A-N, and what Cyan held is that state courts retain concurrent jurisdiction for liability actions under the 33 Act. Practically speaking, that means that companies conducting an IPO or a secondary offering can be subject to liability actions in both federal and state court. And in fact, they can be simultaneously in state and federal court with no procedural mechanism to combine them. As a result of this, there has been a wave of state court 33 Act filings, particularly in California and New York, but in other states as well, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Texas. And in many instances, these state court securities class action lawsuits are accompanied by a parallel federal court 33 Act liability action, identical allegation, same transaction, but with no mechanism to combine them. Shortly after these developments, a proposal began circulating. A lot of people refer to it as the Grunfest proposal in recognition of Stanford Law School professor Joseph Grunfest, who first proposed this idea. And the idea is that IPO companies should incorporate into their charter documents a provision specifying that 33 Act liability actions should be brought in federal court. This proposal was taken up by a number of companies, and many recent IPO companies have adopted federal forum provisions, or FFP, as they're slickly referred to sometimes. A shareholder filed a challenge to the FFP, the federal forum provisions, and the charters of three companies, including Blue Apron, Roku, and Stitch Fix. And the Delaware Chancery Court, in response to the lawsuit that the shareholder filed, found that federal forum provisions are invalid. However, the companies appealed that ruling to the Delaware Supreme Court, and in March 2020, in a case with the almost unpronounceable name of Shaba Cookie, Shaba Cookie held that federal forum provisions are valid and enforceable under Delaware law, at least facially valid and enforceable, a positive development for the advocates of the federal forum provisions and a positive development for those who are seeking to have all Securities Act litigation consolidated in federal court. The question was, after Shaba Cookie, whether the courts of other jurisdictions would enforce federal forum provisions in the charters of Delaware corporations. And there have been a series of three rulings in California state court. The first one was in September, Restoration Robotics. The second one was in November involving Uber. And the third one was just a week ago involving Dropbox. And in each case, the California state court judge ruled in those cases that each one of those companies, by the way, are Delaware corporations, but in each case, the California state court judge held that the federal forum provisions in those companies' charters are valid and enforceable and granted the defendants motions to dismiss the cases on forum nonconvenience grounds. That's a very positive development, and it certainly bespeaks a consensus of view, at least in California courts, that these kinds of provisions are valid and that they can be used as a basis to dismiss cases filed in state court for companies that have those provisions in their charter. Significantly, the Dropbox case, the provision was not in the company's charter, but it was in their bylaws, but the court still found it was valid. And it's a lot easier to amend bylaws than it is to amend charter. So that's a positive development. A lot of people have reacted to me, does this mean that the cyan problem has gone away? It certainly looks less worse than it did before, but there are a lot of things that still have not yet been resolved. First and foremost, although most public companies are Delaware corporations, many are not. Many tech companies are domiciled in Nevada. All real estate investment trusts are domiciled in Maryland. Many financial services companies are registered in New York. And of course, 17% of the U.S. listed companies are foreign companies. They're not domiciled in any U.S. state. So there's still a lot of public companies that it's just not clear whether under the applicable laws under which they're the jurisdiction in which they're incorporated, whether such a provision would be enforceable. And then there's still the question of would the courts of other states other than California and Delaware enforce such a provision? I think eventually this will get sorted out. I think eventually all of these issues will be addressed and resolved by courts, but eventually could be a very long time. And in the meantime, it will be very procedurally complicated. It will be cumbersome and it will be expensive. And it will be some time before all of this is resolved. I think it's important to note when we're talking about the practical consequence of cyan, my day job, I help public companies place their D&O insurance. And I'm here to tell you that the cost of D&O insurance for IPO companies has more than doubled since the cyan decision, and the self-insured retentions or the deductible has quadrupled. So there are very real costs associated with this situation. And so here's my ultimate message. This is a mess of Congress's creation. In 1998, Congress passed a statute called the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act and attempted to amend the jurisdictional provision of the 33 Act to eliminate concurrent jurisdiction. The whole point of SLUSA was to consolidate all securities litigation in federal court. Well, they made a mess of it. One of the justices in the U.S. Supreme Court during the oral argument at cyan described the language in Section 22 of the 33 Act as incomprehensible. It was a mess, but Congress intended federal securities litigation to be in federal court. It would take a stroke of the pen to fix this. This is there are probably six plaintiff lawyers in the country that are in favor of the current state of play, but every other person that cares about efficiency or the rational operation of our legal system would want this change to come about. So those of you who are involved in congressional activities, I would like to say that for the new Congress, here's a easy, low-hanging piece of fruit that bipartisan majorities of both parties could easily get behind. And it'd be a good way to get the new Congress off to a great start and pass a piece of legislation that really needs to be passed. So I'll get off my soapbox now, but those are my two cents on the science situation. Donald?
Excellent. Thank you to all of our panelists for very informative opening remarks and hitting a diverse number of topics. I want to give each of you a chance to react to anything that you might have heard. I know that some people already staked their claim to do so. So in this round, I hope that Kevin will tell us a little bit about his thoughts on events-driven litigation. And Steve, maybe you can tell us a little bit about, you know, parallel state and federal suits and how you see that as a strategy or useful or not useful, and whether or not you would be supportive of the kinds of change Kevin is indicating. Laura, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what you thought about each of the other comments as well and what you're seeing in your own practice. So why don't I turn over to Laura to give us any thoughts in response to things that you might have heard.
Sure. Kevin, I'll give some reactions to your remarks. And I am coming from the defense perspective, in case that isn't clear. But you know, it is a real challenge, the mess that cyan has wrought, with respect to now dealing with parallel state and federal court litigation arising from the same offering. Challenging the same offering documents as being false and misleading. And it's all supposed to be subject to the same substantive law. But as a practical matter, you have cases that are now, you have cases that are in federal court and then the exact same case or same complaint being brought in state court. And Whereas in federal court, there is a mechanism through the PSLRA to get all your cases in the same court and get them all, in front of the same judge. In state court, we don't have that, so there can be multiple state court actions. And then also you'll have your federal court action. And I have litigated these cases where we have a state court judge and a federal court judge reaching different decisions on a motion to dismiss in these cases, where, for example, the federal court judge will grant our motion to dismiss, and the state court judge will deny whatever the state court equivalent of the motion to dismiss is. So you're having courts reach completely different determinations on the pleading of these types of complaints. And then as a practical matter too, it makes a big difference for discovery in federal court. You have the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act mandated a stay of discovery through the decision of a motion to dismiss. In state court, you don't necessarily have that. You start to fight over whether that stay of discovery is a procedural or substantive rule. So it does really make a big difference. It makes a big difference, and it impacts settlement dynamics as well as litigation dynamics. So it has really created this quagmire that we are dealing with, and it's extremely expensive for companies who have to now litigate these cases in multiple forums. So it is a problem, and I think, as Kevin said, that it could be remedied. I don't know if Steve takes a differing view on that, but. Those are my two cents on it.
Before you jump in, Steve, let me just remind the audience that you can submit a question in the Q&A. The queue is open, so please submit any questions to the panelists. We'll be reaching those very soon at the bottom of your screen, or you can email ccjca@gmu.edu. Steve, over to you.
Okay. So I wanted to ask a question about legislative efforts. I know, Kevin, you talked about the 1998 statute, the Standards Act. Why, and maybe there weren't the volume of cases filed in state and federal under Section 11 at that time, but it could have been a provision inserted in there to kind of eliminate, the right to bring Section 11 cases in state court. And of course, now, as opposed to this effort that apparently you're seeing, or we're all seeing, of companies, and I guess we could end up with hundreds or thousands of companies changing their charter and then having the issue attacked and litigated, one simple piece of legislation, one sentence in Congress saying, hey, let's change Section 11 so you can't file in state court. Is there no effort to do that, or why hasn't that been the route as opposed to the charter route?
So when Congress passed SLUSA in 1998, they did attempt to amend Section 22 of the 33 Act, which is the jurisdictional provision. But I think we all know what they were trying to do, but what they actually did was not clear. And that really is the essence of the problem. So Congress attempted to address it in SLUSA in 1998. It was a poor drafting job. You're right that... most companies are going to adopt charter provisions or bylaws, including federal forum provisions. There's a whole lot of corporate and litigation activity that could be eliminated if Congress were to address this. I'd like to point out that all of the plaintiffs still have a full and adequate alternative remedy in federal court. They're not losing their right to pursue their claims. It's simply attempting to complete the operation that Congress started but didn't complete with SLUSA in 1998. So to me, it's a straightforward proposition. Why hasn't Congress done anything? The short answer is I don't know. The longer one, it has to do with the divided and distracted nature of Congress. You mentioned the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce has been trying to pursue that. And, I don't know how they go about these things. I'm not a Washington insider, but I understand they have been trying to see if they could get one or more members of Congress interested in fixing this, and it's a no-brainer. It would take, six words, you could fix it. Someone that's more expert in the actions or inactions of Congress would have to weigh in on why they haven't addressed this.
Yeah, we generally always file in federal court Section 11 cases, And I am involved in one of the cases, like Laura said, on the other way around, where we're in federal court and we won the motion to dismiss and the state court granted the motion to dismiss. So I think the plaintiff's lawyers that file in state court have the view that state courts are generally friendlier forms than federal courts. I kind of find federal courts are quite good. That's been my experience, is pretty much all in federal courts, except with some rare exceptions. And so I'm comfortable. And but, you know, it's the luck of the draw when you file in terms of the judge and, you know, that judge's particular views on the cases.
There is academic research by Professor Klausner at Stanford Law School substantiating that the motion to dismiss are denied with a much higher, greater frequency in state court than in federal court, which obviously is one of the reasons why plaintiffs might want to be in state court rather than federal court.
Steve, before we turn to Kevin for his general reactions to the panel comments, one quick question for you. How do you see statutes like AB 979 or the NASDAQ rule that Laura mentioned affecting your ability or affecting the scope of available claims, particularly event-driven type claims, whether that label is appropriate or not, but sort of the idea of do these statutes change the litigation landscape in your practice?
Well, I haven't seen that. I mean, we have done a number of what I'd say are Me Too cases. And Laura referred to the Alphabet case, but I don't know if it's the one that we did. Our case is not about, you know, more diversity or anything, but more about sexual harassment and things of that nature. But I haven't, I don't know what these statutes might do. You know, it's too soon to know on this board diversity issue. I don't think it really would affect the kind of cases that we tend to get involved with.
Thank you. Kevin, do you have some reactions?
I do. First, on Laura's comments about the board diversity lawsuits, I just have one observation. I'm going to distinguish the Pinterest case, which was filed recently, because that was really more about underlying allegations of gender pay disparity and gender differentiation and advancement within Pinterest. Not so much about board diversity. If we accept the Pinterest case, the last board diversity lawsuit that was filed was the one filed against Cisco Systems on September 25th. And I mention that because it was on September 30th that California Governor Gavin Newsom signed AB 979, the California Board Diversity Statute. Since that statute went into law, there have been no more lawsuits filed. I think in part because I think if you look at what the relief the plaintiffs are seeking in those cases, much of what they're after is now required by the California statute. So there may be fewer of those kinds of lawsuits. There will be more lawsuits of the kind that Steve mentioned about Alphabet and Pinterest, where there's underlying employment-related misconduct alleged, and that turns into a DNO lawsuit, where they claim that there was board malfeasance or misfeasance that contributed to the underlying employment misconduct. So it's been a phenomenon of this year. There have been, half a dozen to a dozen companies sued. I don't know how many of those lawsuits, at least of that type, we will see. On Steve's comments about the event-driven litigation, I will be the first to stipulate that there have been very meritorious event-driven lawsuits, and certainly the cases he mentioned are great examples. Where I think we differ is that there are a lot more of these kind of lawsuits than there used to be. And that's within the context of, there are just a lot more securities lawsuits than there used to be. If you allow for the reduced number of public companies that are listed in the United States now compared to, say, the 90s, the rate of litigation is much higher than it's ever been. The chance of a publicly listed company in the United States getting hit with a securities lawsuit is more than double the long-term historical average. And that's even if you factor out all the merger-related litigation. If you just look at core traditional 10b-5 or Section 11 cases, the litigation rate is above 5% compared to a long-term average of about 2.5%, meaning that about 1 in 20 companies every year is going to get with a securities lawsuit. What's driving all of this increased litigation isn't that there's more fraud. It's that more lawsuits are being filed. And the more lawsuits that are being filed are the event-driven lawsuits. There's a small part of the plaintiff's bar, not Steve's firm, but there is a small part of the plaintiff's firm that have been euphemistically called the emerging law firms that are very active and very aggressive, and they're filing a lot of these event-driven lawsuits. First you have the event, then you have the lawsuit. And sooner or later, everything is a securities lawsuit because it's a setback in the business operations of the company. It's a regulatory development. It's anything that can happen in the life of a company, and it all becomes a securities lawsuit. So I have no concern whatsoever that there are and can be meritorious event-driven lawsuits. It's just that, as Steve himself acknowledged, not all of them are meritorious. Many of them are not meritorious. And in fact, the dismissal rate is going up relative to historic levels.
So
point, Steve, do you have some, Steve or Laura, do you have a reply? Looks like Laura, you have something to say. Go ahead.
So I had two thoughts come to mind there with respect to Kevin's comments. First, on the idea of whether there have been more securities filings, I think for the past couple of years, we've just seen securities filings go up, 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 up. And then I looked at Cornerstone has put out their report on the filings from the first half of the year. It'll be very interesting to me to see what happens for the second half of the year. NERA put out a report as well. But they actually found that filings were, and these kind of core non-M&A related filings were actually down for the first half of the year. And they attribute that to the to COVID hitting in large part, because when COVID hit, you just had the markets kind of come to a stop for a few months. So for the first 2 or 3 months of 2020, they were still on this upward trajectory, right? And then for a few months, everything kind of ground to a halt for a little bit there. And all M&A activity really kind of ceased to exist for a little bit there. So now that has ticked back up. So I'll be interested to see what happens for the second half of 2020. But that was just kind of, they were reporting, the headline of the report was, you know, securities filings are down 18% compared to the second half of 2019, and at the lowest level since 2016. But then you really saw that, no, that's probably just a blip, and we're probably for the rest of the 2020 headed back on that same trajectory of just this massive increase in securities fraud suits. And then another kind of reaction that Kevin, that I had to your statements were with respect to the event-driven litigation and many of those cases not being meritorious, you know, we on the defense side say that it's alleging fraud by hindsight, that this surprise happens to a company and their business is hit by something that they did not expect. And then the plaintiff shareholder comes in and says, well, you should have known about that. Or, you know, you should have been aware of that risk and your risk disclosure should have been better surrounding that issue. There's two competing factors. We've got really great defenses against those types of claims. The flip side is that they often involve really big damages numbers, because you've got this, again, really big surprise that happened. And if the stock price goes down, you're looking at some really big damages numbers. So that's going to, you know, drive the settlement value in these cases, even when you do have really good defenses. It's good to hear that courts are increasingly granting those motions to dismiss and getting those cases out at an early juncture. But I do think, you know, that when you don't get the motion to dismiss granted, then you've got a lot of pressure to settle at very high numbers in those types of event-driven litigation cases.
Steve, there's quite a bit to respond to there, I think. So I'll give you a few minutes and then we'll open it up after that to Q&A.
Okay, yeah, I'm trying to figure out where to start. I'd say, you know, the number of cases, and I'm glad Kevin differentiated between what's known as these merger cases versus kind of the standard 10b-5 cases, whether it's cooking the books or it's some kind of big event that's happened. The merger cases we tend to not even focus on. And when I see some entities like the Chamber, you know, talk about the securities litigation exploding, they tend to include the merger cases, which all of us in the field kind of discount. Those are cases that some lawyers file that were used to be filed in Delaware Chancery Court, and then the lawyers were not thrilled with how the Chancery Court was paying fees, so they started filing some in federal court. They'd be filed and then quickly settled or dismissed. So when you take those out of the mix, because those cases really don't last very long at all, the number of securities cases is pretty stable. It's really for two decades now. It's been, I mean, it's in a range of 200 to 250 generally. Some years it's under 200. Some years it could be in the mid or high 200s. So it's been pretty stable. The dismissal rate, as Kevin referred to, has generally gone up. And truthfully, I think the reason for that is there are cases being filed that shouldn't be filed. There are, you know, we are at my firm, you know, very careful. We don't win every case, but we don't file that many cases. We just think many of the cases filed are weak. And it's unfortunate. And that, I guess, makes why we have higher numbers. But I guess for the judges, hopefully, are seeing through the cases and seeing, you know, looking at the facts that are alleged. And if they're not strong enough, they are dismissing them. And what I always worry about is when you get into, you know, these nomenclatures or terms like event driven, or you try to paint all these things as bad, that there are cases that are kind of on the borderline that used to be sustained at the motion dismiss level that I've seen getting dismissed that I know really shouldn't be. And so that's, I kind of just worry about some kind of trend happening that based on labels. But again, I think in general, the courts are doing a good job of weeding out the good from the bad. And there are too many cases that are filed that really should not be filed. I don't know how you, I guess corporations have the same problem to weed out the bad actors from committing fraud. I don't know. We don't have any control over some law firms that want to file a case that where we think that shouldn't be filed. You can't stop them.
So we have a few questions and 15 minutes left. So if we can keep our, if you can all keep your answers relatively short on each of these, that would be great. So the first question is just pivoting off of what Steve just said, the good and the bad. What are the principal ways or metrics that a judge should be looking at to differentiate between the good and the bad events driven or, you know, what makes an appropriate lawsuit versus an inappropriate lawsuit for purposes of whether it be 10b-5 or Section 11 or something else? How do we distinguish?
Well, let me start off that because, you know, again, we have to make those analyses and weigh in whether to file a case or not. And when we are involved in a case and appointed as lead counsel, you know, what we need to have in the complaint where we hope will win, you know, get us past the motion to dismiss. So ultimately, it's the facts that tend to show the corporation or its executives had knowledge or were reckless in not having knowledge about the, you know, adverse events that were occurring. Laura just referred to the issue, for instance, of fraud by hindsight, which is one of the arguments that we hear a lot, you know, when motions to dismiss are filed that defense counsel use. And the argument she made that, you know, the corporations, you know, plaintiffs say they should have been aware. Should have been aware generally does not do it. You know, we have to allege more than that. And the courts are, you know, the standards have been raised very high, but they're not insurmountable. They're higher than I'd like. I think they're somewhat too stringent. You know, that came about from the PSLRA that was passed in 1995 and as interpreted by the courts. But, you know, there is enough in terms of factual support we can put in, you know, getting confidential witnesses, former employees of companies, many times will help you get past that. Sometimes you don't have that information, but you just have to do a thorough investigation to get enough facts. And in a sense, it's like, you know, to pass the smell test that the courts will use to say, have you alleged enough to show recklessness and all the other standards that we have to meet?
And I have to say that when we, you know, from the defense side, when we are looking at these big, long amended complaints, you know, when we're seeing lots of confidential witnesses that the plaintiffs have talked to, particularly ones that have access or to the makers of the challenge statements, meaning people that have access to the CEO, the CFO, the C-suite, you know, that's something that I think that courts put a lot of weight and emphasis on those confidential witnesses, as well as any internal documents that those confidential witnesses refer to. So in some cases, you'll get, you know, one, two, or a dozen confidential witnesses. But that's certainly something that we take a look at. But as Steve said, they're still able to, in many cases, the plaintiff is still able to get past a motion to dismiss without those confidential witnesses by pulling together other information. Donald, I just wanted to make sure that you were aware that there are two questions in the Q&A box at the bottom of my Zoom,
yep,
at least.
We're getting to them. Okay.
Yep. And one other thing I'll add, which again, why I say the standard or the burden on plaintiff is tough, you know, years ago, and this is when the law changed, we used to be able to get discovery in many cases before you had to file your amended complaint. And I will tell you, in virtually any case, if we could get discovery before the amended complaint, I am almost certain we would have enough evidence to win that motion. But the law changed and said you cannot get discovery before you have to file your amended complaint. So, it really has made it tougher for the plaintiffs to get by and win these motions. And so usually when you do, you know, you really have sufficient evidence that there is a case that is viable. It doesn't mean you're guaranteed to win, but, you know, you get past the motion, then you go into the full-blown discovery and hopefully build the case, make it stronger, and the defendants will argue when you get in discovery, you're not going to find anything to make it stronger, and the battle continues.
Kevin, a couple of thoughts on this, and then as Laura's mentioned, we do want to fill out the queue.
I actually agree with everything that Steve said, and if the plaintiff's lawyers have done their work, my reaction when I read the complaint for the first time would be, there's something here. And if you have that reaction, the chances are that the plaintiffs are going to survive the motion to dismiss. What I look for when I read a complaint for the first time is, what are the scienter allegations? What are the allegations of fraudulent intent or recklessness and loss causation? Because increasingly with these increased numbers of lawsuits, and yes, the number of lawsuits is state level. The thing is, the number of public companies has declined dramatically. There are 40% fewer publicly traded companies than there were 20 years ago. So it may be the same number of lawsuits, but the ratio of lawsuits to companies has gone way up. So as there have been more lawsuits filed, more and more of these lawsuits are being filed for very small stock price drops, to the point that it could be just the normal variation daily trading in the company's securities rather than any reaction to the supposed clarifying statement. So that's what I look at. I look at the scienter allegations and the loss causation allegations.
Thank you very much. So our next question comes from Christopher Kramer, and he poses this question to you, Kevin, but the panel generally as well. Are there any observed trends in state court IPO settlements? There seemed to be a cluster in August and September, according to Mr. Kramer. Also, what does the state court settlement mean for the simultaneous federal court action? So first, any observed trends in state court IPOs? And then when a case settles in state court, how does that affect the federal action?
Well, it's harder to get the information on the state court settlements. There's much better mechanisms to know about the federal court settlements. So I'm going to have to plead some limited ignorance on this. I do know that there was a significant settlement in California just in the last few weeks where actually the federal case and the state case settled within a few days of each other. And I can only imagine how complicated that was. I know Laura has some experience with that. So I'm going to defer to her on the impact on settlement dynamics from the existence of parallel state and federal cases.
Yeah, so I've been involved in a few settlements in the past year or so where there's been a state court and parallel or related federal court action. And some of those are still being litigated or are kind of in settlement. But I'll tell you this, it gets very complicated. And it certainly would be the defense position in many of these cases where if you're settling the class claims in one action or the other, that's going to settle all the claims unless there's a specific carve out. If somehow they aren't totally overlapping. So unless there's a specific carve out for the other case or specific, you know, date or particular type of claim in the other case, or unless you get plaintiffs that are excluding themselves, but that otherwise, the class settlement needs to be respected by the court that it's not being sought in. But I do think that it gets very complicated when you've got these parallel actions, and we have seen those complications arise in our settlements and as we're proceeding with negotiating those settlements.
I've only had limited experience with that happening, and most times it's worked out where the defendant has gone to plaintiff's counsel in both state and federal and, you know, settled them together under one umbrella. But you can imagine the problems if they can't agree because, and I don't remember the name of the Supreme Court opinion, but you can effectively, I believe, you know, settle with one and kind of cram down the other. And basically the other one gets released. And you can imagine the plaintiff's lawyers in the other case that gets released, you know, who aren't getting paid while the other action's getting settled will not be happy. And then they will probably try to object and fight it. I don't think they can win that, but it could become a messy situation. So it's easier to resolve them both at the same time.
Thank you. Our next question is really a potential reform that I think Professor Myers would like you to respond to. So it comes from Professor Minor Myers, who teaches corporate and securities law at the University of Connecticut School of Law. And Professor Myers is curious about the political dynamics surrounding the potential reforms to Section 11 claims. So any responses to the political dynamics would be great. And then he continues, part of the heat involved in the Delaware case is that the bylaws are seen as a proxy battle for the question of whether a bylaw could force all security claims into arbitration. Would a potential compromise set of reforms for Congress be pairing one, ensuring that Section 11 claims can be filed only in federal court, and two, making clear that a stockholder can only be forced to arbitrate securities claims by personal contract and not by a bylaw or charter provision? So that's a multi-part proposal slash question, and I invite responses from any of the panelists.
You know, I'm kind of laughing a little bit on hearing the question because it goes back to what I had asked Kevin about a little bit, and I hate to say it, I think, and I'm not a political insider, but I just think it points to the problem of trying to get anything passed in Congress. And so this question, you know, brought up the idea of kind of, in a sense, getting two ideas passed in the same bill, which is wonderful. It's just that it's, you can't get Congress to agree, and you know, each party is fighting each other, and if they give one inch on one issue, they're afraid it's going to lead to more problems. And so that's the dynamic, is how to get the two sides to work together.
You know, the question about what impact resolving this in Congress could have on the long-running suggestion that you could adopt a mandatory arbitration provision requiring security suits to be arbitrated. That question has been sort of a steady drumbeat in the background of all of this discussion about federal forum provisions, because, so the argument goes, all an arbitration provision would be another kind of forum provision, specifying arbitration as the forum. I think it's different because the plaintiffs in who are no longer able to go to state court have a full and fair equivalent alternative of going to federal court. So I think it's, they're apples and oranges. I think you can't equate a federal forum provision specifying a federal forum with a forum provision specifying an arbitration forum. I think they ask and answer two completely different questions. So I hope those two things don't get conflated as we're talking about whether or not Congress should revise the jurisdiction provision of the 33 Act. I just think those are, they're often mixed together, but I would like to keep them separate because I think it's a different discussion.
Yeah, and of course the plaintiff's bar clearly would be fighting and has been fighting tooth and nail any effort to go to arbitration, mandatory arbitration, which, you know, would basically eliminate the class action cases. So, you know, we have been fighting that for years. There's been litigation in Delaware, and I gather it's still going on, other efforts.
Kevin, what do you think of the Delaware Supreme Court's response to the arbitration concern? I feel like it was in a footnote at the end of I've been calling this decision the wrong name forever. I always call it Skybucci, but Shabakuki. Yeah. it was in this, I think it was in a footnote or at the very end of their decision.
It was at the very end.
Yeah, what do you think of the Delaware Supreme Court?
I don't think the Delaware Supreme Court engaged on it. I think they wanted to try and say, look, by reaching the decision we're reaching, we're not opening the door to an arbitration provision. By saying that, it doesn't make it so. I feel like it's this embedded topic that's sitting there that we'll eventually have to deal with. You know, the SEC may be able to control it because obviously they have the right through the registration process to supervise what the companies that are filing can do. So, you know, the SEC could wind up being the mechanism that controls whether companies that seek to adopt an arbitration bylaw are successful.
We are at the top of our hour, but I will go 3 minutes over and just ask each of you to offer any final thoughts on projections for the future or thoughts that you hope our audience will walk away with. Steve, you want to start?
Boy, I don't know. We've covered everything, and I can't predict what's coming next, just like we never in our world of securities cases, everyone always asks, what's the next genre of cases? And we don't know. There's always fraud of always a different type, and that's what we're there to help protect investors. So I don't have anything else to add. Thanks.
Kevin?
It's really just kind of a follow-up of the colloquy Steve and I are having about event-driven litigation. We managed to talk about it without talking about the pandemic-related litigation, which is sort of the ultimate event-related litigation. Even though we're well into the public health crisis phase of this, I think the economic recovery phase will be even longer, and I think that's going to produce a lot of litigation, and much of it will be of this event-driven type. So that's my crystal ball prediction for 2021.
Laura.
Sure. So I was, Kevin stole my thunder. I was also going to mention the pandemic, any pandemic related securities litigation. There was a lot written in the spring and summer about, it's going to be a wave of pandemic related litigation. And I just don't think that we've seen that thus far. I have some theories about why that hasn't been, but I'll be interested to see if that actually does come, in the coming months and next year.
And I'll just add back to that. You know, I was quoted back in the spring but in some reporter on this topic, and I said, boy, I hope the plaintiffs bar does not start filing cases when stock drops because of COVID and everything. And I know we have stayed away from it. There have been a number of cases like against the shipping lines, the cruise lines rather. And so there are a half a dozen or more. Now, there was one that could be valid where they said a company said we have a cure, for COVID and, allegedly did not. And so maybe something like that could be valid. I don't know. But some of the other ones, we have stayed away from. But Kevin raises a good point. Will there be more? I don't know. I mean, in this bull market we're having for a while, that certainly cuts back on litigation.
I'd like to thank again Laura Hughes McNally for joining us, Steve Toll as well, and Kevin LaCroix for joining us on this panel today, The Changing Landscape of Securities Litigation, Mergers, Events-Based Securities Claims, and Emerging Litigation and Settlement Dynamics in Federal and State Courts, brought to you by the Law and Economics Center at George Mason University's Scalia Law School. It's been wonderful to have all of the panelists here with us today. This will be a continuing conversation. We hope we'll have them all back again soon for more on this and other related topics. We thank all of you for joining us here at the Law and Economics Center. We hope you'll tune in for future webinars and podcasts that are available at masonlec.org. So visit masonlec.org, that's masonlec.org, to learn all about Law and Economics Center programming and to watch on demand this and other programs that are posted on the website. I hope you all have a wonderful afternoon. And for those of you who we do not see again, very happy holidays. Thank you.
Thank you.